It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
I'm Kefi.
And our special guest today is Jose Iriarte.
Very good.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm waving, even though nobody on a podcast can see that.
We're coming to you live from ICFA, the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts.
It's live technically now, but it wouldn't be live.
But we're all in the same room, which is important to know because it makes sense that Sean is actually waving at us.
This is true. So, really quick, before we kind of start going down the rabbit hole, don't laugh. The rabbit holes are wonderful. They're a wonderful place. Rabbits hang out in them. They do wonderful things. They're like LSD. It's wonderful. tell us a little bit about your work and some of your recent sales.
Okay. I write young adult / middle grade novels. Hopefully we'll find a home for one soon. And I also write science fiction and fantasy short stories. My short stories I really love genre stories, and that's all I read. But for whatever crazy reason, what I write comes out a little bit more interstitial than that. So I tend to have the spec element very understated. So understated that some people will read it and go, "Where's the spec in this?" So things of mine that you can read. I'm proudest of my sale Yuka and Dominoes that was published in Strange Horizons on November 4th. And also,
and I edited that.
Yes. And also, my story Cabron, excuse me, is in Stupefying Stories, the Halloween horror issue.
Oh, excellent. So one of the things that we were talking about off podcast, but we should really kind of hash out here, is this idea that you were presenting about having a community for Latino writers, presumably international in scope. And so I was hoping you'd maybe sort of start off by talking a little bit about, I mean, what is it for you that would be the reason why you'd really want that? I mean, other than the obvious sort of like, because we need a community, but I mean, like, what kind of value would you think that would add to our, you know?
Well, I'm a member of Outer Alliance, and I'm not very active there, but I do read all the emails that go around, and I really kind of appreciate that sense of camaraderie, and you know, if you are somewhat on the margins, it's nice to find those other people who are out there with you, so that, you know, you can promote each other and just be aware, and maybe if you've got wisdom to share with each other. I'm aware of Broad Universe, and I felt like I would love to see a similar thing for Latino writers.
So, out of curiosity, I mean, this may be like a resounding no question, but have there been any specific Latino writers who have influenced your own writing? Whether directly or indirectly?
For the most part, I would say that Gabriel Garcia Marquez has influenced my writing, and I hope that you can see that if you read Yucan Dominoes, that you see that influence there. I'm trying to think. And sadly, no, because I've cut my teeth on reading genre fiction. I just haven't seen a lot of representation of Latinos there.
It's interesting. Out of curiosity, since you mentioned Marquez, have you read The Last Voyage of the Ghost Ship?
No, I have not. Okay.
He's more famous, obviously, for 100 Years of Solitude. That's sort of the novel everybody remembers him for, and probably why he got the Nobel. That story has only commas and one period at the end. It's like, in my book that I have it in, it's like 7 pages. It's all one sentence about a boy in a ghost ship. I'm doing a horrible rendition of what it's about, but it's sort of like a reverse of the Boy and the Wolf, Boy Who Cried Wolf story, but it reverses it where nobody believes him from the start, and then they believe him in the end because he breaks a ghost ship. Whereas, obviously, in the opposite.
I'm glad you explained that, because I was trying to figure out how you reversed that story.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking that maybe it was like a wolf who believed in boys.
Yes.
Like the ghost ship was telling his parents, there's a boy out there.
No, it's just a really, I think it's a really fascinating story. Not just, I mean, it's Marquez, so, you know, he's a pretty fascinating writer in general. But, I mean, just the, structurally, I mean, it's a story that, I'd never read anything quite like that with no punctuation other than commas in one period. So it's something maybe to check out.
I definitely.
So I have a question for you, because I can definitely see what you're saying when you say that you can dominoes, you can kind of see the kind of influences there, and I think a lot of people would consider that to be magical realism. But I think that that's also something that I've seen other and heard other Latino writers express frustration about, that if you write something and you're Latino, it gets branded as magical realism, whether you wanted it to or not. How do you feel about that?
I haven't really been published long enough to run into any frustrations with that. Magic realism has always been something that I've really enjoyed as a reader. My first exposure to it actually was Gloria Naylor's Mama Day, which was a book that just blew me the heck away. And so for now, I mean, if that's a box and if that's confining, I haven't yet run up against that.
Okay. So do you set out to write what you would consider magical realism?
I think with Yukon Dominoes more so than with other stories I write, it just kind of seems to end up that way. The story ideas I get, I think I approach writing differently than many of the people that I'm friends with, and maybe that's why I don't have more sales, I don't know. Whereas a lot of people I know seem to come up with the SF null, well, you know, come up with that what if, and I'm really, I start with the emotional thing that I want to explore. So in the case of Yukon Dominoes, it was riding that line between two cultures and, you know, trying to navigate and be true to your culture, but also experience the culture that you're, the wider culture that you're living in, and you know, how do you do that correctly? And that's a recurring theme for me. That's one that I come back to a lot. Go figure. So.
Cultural immersion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so let's talk about your actual personal background.
Mm-hmm.
But you come back to that theme, you say it's a big surprise, go figure, but tell us a little bit about your background and why that is a big thing for you.
Well, I'm Cuban-American. I was born in Florida, grew up in Miami, in and out of the Little Havana area. So my first language was Spanish, started kindergarten not speaking a word of English, And if you've not spent a lot of time in Miami, and again, it's a fine line because I don't want to sound deprecating of it because I think it's wonderful. But if you have not spent a lot of time there, you may not realize to what extent you can really be within that Cuban culture and be immersed in it. You know, I've had people express disappointment. Oh, well, you were born in this country. Well, yeah, but this was the culture that I lived and breathed until TBH, at least. So that's my background. I went to a Cuban-American high school that was literally transplanted from Cuba to the United States. My high school's most famous alumni is, in fact, Fidel Castro. So I went
really?
To his high school, yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And the high school that Raul Castro got kicked out of. and you know, it took me many years to realize that nobody had a high school experience like mine in this country. When people talk about their high school experience, like, we just didn't realize it because this was, you know, the air we breathed and the water we swam in, but it's just a very alien and very different from, you know, I teach in a high school now, so I'm very familiar with American schools. And we had a different mentality.
So that's interesting when you're talking about your early immersion in Cuban culture, and you write a lot of stories with Latino and Latina characters, I was wondering, actually, if you feel pressure to get published, if you feel pressure to sort of anglicize the culture that you're writing about or the characters that you're writing about sort of externally.
What I feel or what I felt isn't tangible pressure. It hit me at one point a few years back, I don't know, 5 to 10 years back, that almost every story I wrote had a white protagonist. And there were very few exceptions. And I started to analyze that and think, well, what's going on there? And why don't I write characters whose experiences and backgrounds resemble mine? And I realize that I'd never really seen a lot of characters like that. And I know there's wonderful people out there doing great work that I just wasn't familiar with. So I don't want to suggest it doesn't exist, but nobody had shared it with me. Nobody had pointed me in that direction. So, you know, I had kind of internalized the idea that protagonist meant white and Caucasian and very likely male as well. And when I realized I was doing that, I tried to very consciously steer away from that. Now to the point where, you know, both of the stories of mine that you can find out there feature teenage Latina characters. And I'm like, well, that's not the only thing I can write, I'm sure.
It's really interesting when you talk about, I'm not originally from Florida, I'm from California, so it's a very different Latino culture, I guess you could say. Although I'm from Northern California, so it's even more different. Just from the South. But one of the interesting things when I moved to Florida is how there does seem to be a very clear division in the state. Like, if you're up in where I'm in Gainesville, that's, just to use the colloquial term, hick territory. Well, except Gainesville isn't because it's a college town, but around there, you know, farm. But then you start going down, and it becomes increasingly more like not America, because it becomes increasingly more Latino, huge Cuban community, which is a very interesting experience. And I'm very curious about, you know, since you sort of grew up in this culture, and presumably have now, as you've mentioned, have learned now teaching at a different sort of high school. Mm-hmm. What are some of the big differences that you mean that would be helpful for us to sort of identify that you notice either culturally or just in the way things are generally done?
Well, the cultural differences in my high school that I attended may not have been strictly due to being a Cuban high school, although I think that was at the heart of it. But it was also it was an all-boys school and just kind of a unique atmosphere there. I'm trying to think of English words that would describe it. It was, in many cases, just a little bit of a madhouse, you know. A lot of posturing and a lot of trying to be the wildest person and things like that. And I feel like I've given you a totally unsatisfactory answer, but...
can you tell us, because you say you're trying to find an English word, what are the words that you would use?
Bayuseria.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, if you were to explain that in English without it being one word, how would you explain it?
Well, like I said, a madhouse, just chaos. It's a very chaotic situation. And things that seemed normal in my high school experience that I look around now and careers would end. You know, definitely, you know, growing up, I've had adults give me alcohol. You know, adults who were responsible for my education. Because within my culture growing up, hey, you know, that's not unusual. That's not unheard of. You try to teach your kids not to abuse it, but you don't have this demarcation of, bang, you're 21, suddenly you're old enough to drink, things like that. We had a teacher at my school that he made it known that his preferred Christmas gift was a single gift-wrapped can of beer. So by the time the Christmas season would end, of course, you don't even get Christmas gifts where I work, but he'd have like 150 cans of beer, and he wouldn't even know which brand they are, just kind of sitting somewhere in the classroom. So just weird little things like that, I think, wow, holy crap, it was really a different world, and to me it just seemed so normal.
Were these gifts from the students?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. If anywhere else, maybe we get fired.
Yes.
I find that such an amusing anecdote. It's something that I think before you came to dinner that we were all kind of talking about the difference in the way alcohol is treated around the world in general. In the United States, it's like, don't drink. You can't drink until you're 21, and it's like...
And then when you are 21, just go nuts if you want to.
It's like party.
Yeah.
Exactly. But in other cultures, it's sort of, in some places, maybe you drink with your parents when you're a lot younger, and you presumably learn responsibility, although obviously some people
maybe
don't.
Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. And others maybe have younger drinking ages, or they have different rules about when you're allowed to drink, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's very interesting to see that, like, even obviously within the United States, that you have that flip. Obviously, you describe it as somewhat crazy, because it's in a culture that, largely speaking, would say new.
Yeah.
But for some reason, there's like a blind spot where that area sort of gets ignored, which I find really fascinating. That it goes back to the thing you were suggesting about cultural immersion, and how much you allow in and from outside and, mm-hmm. and so on and back and forth. And this is one.
And I think another part of it was basically because virtually everybody at my school was Cuban American, and I'm treading a fine line there. You mentioned how it feels like being in another country, because that will bristle me and it will bristle other people.
That's a good point.
The whole, oh well, if you don't speak Spanish in Miami, you can't get a loaf of bread, and that'll raise my hackles faster than anything else. And so that's the line I'm walking, because there's truth to the trope, and then there's the exaggeration. So
that's a good point, yeah.
But in my school, it wasn't like any other school in Miami, maybe 50% Latino or 45% Latino, but because my school literally was from Cuba, it was 99% Cuban. And maybe a few other kids who are other kinds of Latinos and like one American kid, you know? And so just the expectation that everybody around you was bilingual, the expectation that everybody shared the exact same politics, and if you didn't, you know, woe betide unto you, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point not to make it. And I think there's also, and maybe this is just stupid on my part, to call it like it's another country, because of course it's in the United States.
Well, I'm not intending to call you out. I was just
I know.
Throwing out that there's that balance you're trying to walk.
Actually, a good thing to call out, and not just to pile on Sean, but just in general, that we have a very big country and it has a lot of different subcultures,
yeah.
and those are all part of American culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
So your Cuban American culture is also American culture.
Yeah,
it's important to recognize that that is a valid
right.
U.S. culture.
Right. Yeah, no, and that was just me backpedaling on the use of the language, because when you think about that language and you say it's like another country, it's like, no. That's part of the point, right, that this is not a country where
mm-hmm.
it's like there are other places. It's all actually, well, in the mythical form, the melting pot, everybody melts together. It doesn't obviously work that
mm-hmm.
way in practice per se, but I think it goes back to that.
Well, it's not about whether it works that way or not. It's about whether the melting pot itself is a problematic analogy.
That's a good question.
I would say that it is.
In what sense? No, go ahead. No, yeah.
Because the melting pot analogy suggests that. How is it the board like to say your
assimilated.
You will be assimilated.
Your uniqueness will be
added to the
added
collective,
to,
or something
added
like
to
that,
the collective,
yeah.
and it suggests that everybody's approaching some mean or some
mm-hmm.
central point, instead of valuing the things that make us different and holding on to the things that make us different.
It's sort of the false dichotomy between, like, did you grow up in a Cuban
mm-hmm.
community or did you grow up in America? And it's like, well, no, it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Cuban community. In America.
In America.
And actually, that was why it was good to point that out, because there are a lot of phrases we use that we don't think about because we've attached different meanings to them as we've used them.
Mm.
And so it's the sort of, like, the things that you say without thinking about them are sometimes the most problematic things that you say. And so it's useful to just think about it, like, oh,
yeah.
I totally did just say that about Miami or,
mm.
you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. We sort of... take on narratives that are sort of told to us maybe by whatever part of the world we happen to be living in this case the United States, and even maybe even subcultures within the U.S. that we adopt these phrases and these ideas that we just assume are, oh, they're just good.
And we're also taught these things when we're kids and we don't necessarily
yeah.
critically examine them. I mean,
we're told not to in many
right.
respects. Yeah.
There's a Schoolhouse Rock song about the Great American Melting Pot, so, you know.
Yeah, it's just, the more I think about the melting pot, the more I just feel like that's such a crap metaphor. It doesn't really address how cultural immersion would work in practice, or necessarily how it should work. I mean, that's what you're suggesting.
So
yeah.
I think this is, oh my gosh, I'm totally doing that thing where someone who's like been in this country for more than four generations is like, now I'm going to talk about my immigrant ancestors, and all the actual immigrants are like, oh my god, here we go. But my point is just, so, I have, and part of why this is on my mind is that the grandfather I'm thinking of did recently pass, and I said that on the podcast, which is like, oh, soft story, but he did recently pass, and he was my Italian grandfather, and that part of the family was, his father had come from Italy and spoke Italian when he entered the country, and because of when they came into this country, which was very, very early 20th century, they totally were part of the melting pot, want to assimilate,
mm-hmm.
that's how you interact with America is that you become an American, and my great-grandfather refused to teach his children Italian because we were going to be Americans, damn it. And that, I think, was harmful for my grandfather's generation, because there's an entire part of their roots that they didn't get to interact with and had no knowledge of, and were surrounded by people who had families that had immigrated from Northern Europe instead. And so I think that it's been damaging for other for groups of people throughout history, but I also feel like it's a type of becoming an American that doesn't always work, and it's also implying that, like, for that you need to not speak Spanish in order to be an American, or, you know, if you go to a school that's all Cuban, then you're not an American, or if you, you know, drink wine at dinner with your Italian grand, you know. And so I'm going on and on, but I do think that the melting pot, like, part of why it's problematic, but also part of why it is persisted, is that it's useful for certain groups in society to act, because then you have, it's sort of the, if it's a melting pot, we're all supposed to assimilate, and we all have, then the dominant American culture, or the dominant Anglo-American culture, has more power, because it's like, oh, we're all, like, you're also on our side, so now we're all, you know, together as Americans. So I just rambled way too long. You're probably not going to cut
well,
most
no,
of that.
I think also, and I'm not sure exactly where that metaphor started, but I think one of the big people who really wanted to popularize it was Henry Ford, and was basically using cheap immigrant labor and saying, like, look, you all need to be good Americans, and we'll melt together, and then you can all have Anglo culture.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you're in America, speak English and do my work, and I will pay you very little, but you can be proud to be an American.
Well, it goes with the, you know, the, throughout the history of this country, and presumably other countries, I don't want to speak for their histories, but that we come up with these ideas that are really good for sort of patriotic posturing, and they're sort of utopian, right? The melting pot idea is supposed to be utopian. Like, look at America. We're not like those other stupid countries that are all just one culture. We're like all these other cultures mixed together, and that's wonderful and great. But then also, obviously, in practice, that has a lot of problems. So you're suggesting, like, with Henry Ford, you know, he's using cheap labor while using this narrative, and obviously to as a manipulation tactic. Or you go even further back, you have Chinese immigrant labor who are actually being denied American citizenship while they're saying, we're a melting pot, and so on and so on and so on. Like, all these examples. And that's not just to, like, piss on the United States and say we're all garbage. But that is to say that, you know, that these narratives are never black and white, where it's like,
right,
melting pot is just good, end of discussion. It's like, no. This is actually, we should be having a discussion about these things.
I think you read it. You hit it right there. It's the absence of nuance.
Yeah.
So I have a question to bring this back.
Yes.
It's a good discussion,
okay, so,
I feel. But yeah.
So my personal history is my father came from Mexico, so I have the first generation American citizen father. And he came over here when he was 15. He was naturalized American citizen, never lost his accent. But and I think this happens a lot with first generation immigrants. They really want their children to have the best opportunity, so they will, like, try to get their children to assimilate as much as possible. So I wasn't taught Spanish as a child. He deliberately kept it from me until I was 12, and then he was like, you should speak it perfectly, and I'm going to yell at you for making mistakes.
Not learned this.
Exactly. So that was not really the good way to teach me Spanish. But it sounds like you grew up bilingual. You had the experience of being first learning Spanish and then going to school and learning English.
Yeah.
But here you are, you're talking to us in English. The stories I've read by you are in English.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the change, and why do you decide to write in English?
I think it's because American pop culture is so all subsuming that, I mean, to my parents' dismay, my parents were the opposite of what you described. They felt like, and for me, it was a perfect decision. I know this could work out otherwise, but they felt like they were going to, as long as they could, shelter me from anything other than my Cuban culture. And because they figured that once I became old enough to watch television or read or whatever, I was going to get plenty of American culture. And for me, that's one of their decisions that I can't fault them for in the least. It really worked out perfectly. I know many people of my generation who have lost their Spanish, and I haven't. But I think what happened, you know, I hit kindergarten not speaking a word of English, and I don't remember exactly when it was that I felt like I had learned English, because I wasn't conscious of that, but I think it was just a matter of months. And, you know, I was at that age where that window, the neurological window of language development is open. So to my parents' great frustration, it was just a matter of months before they would ask me questions in Spanish, and without even thinking about it, I would answer them in English and not even be aware that I was doing it. So while I still am completely fluent in Spanish, and while I can, you know, read it and write it and no problem, I am a bit embarrassed to say more comfortable in English. And while I have written a story in Spanish once that was so bad I sent it to Kefi, I've never really written fiction in Spanish. I've written letters or polemic in Spanish, but not fiction. And while I do consume some fiction in Spanish, I consume much more in English. And I don't consume any Spanish television or anything like that. So that's why I'm more comfortable in English than Spanish.
Have you ever thought about translating your work into Spanish?
You know, it just doesn't seem like I wouldn't know where to send it to.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a lot of effort, and I'm not sure that there's a lot of payoff there. And as far as, you know, the experiences that I have to speak to, I think I've got a lot to say to the immigrant experience, even though I was born in this country, and I've got a lot to say to the first generation American experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I've got a lot to say to the experience of somebody who's simply just lived their whole life in Venezuela or something like that. For, you know, that when people talk about selling foreign rights or translations, I've thought about would some market in another country be interested in Yucca and Domino's, and I don't necessarily see that it would speak to anybody outside of this country, because that's the experience it's really about, is the immigrant experience.
What's interesting to me about that is that because I know a lot of writers and talk to a lot of writers who will just send out things to be translated in other countries, I think it's really interesting that you have that reticence, because you're worried that it wouldn't be that it wouldn't speak to different experiences, like not even just in like Latin America, but you know, other countries like, I don't know, Sweden or Poland or France or whatever, because most of the authors that I speak to who write stories in English who don't have that immigrant background don't have that same worry. At least I almost never hear them express that, like, oh, I don't think that my science fiction story I wrote for an American magazine
mm-hmm.
would play well in other countries. And so I just think it's really interesting that's something that you're concerned
mm-hmm.
with.
I tend to just be reticent in general, but...
Yeah, well, okay. It could just be you.
But I do think that Kefi brings up a really good point, though, because if you look at The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, that's
mm-hmm.
very much immigrant experience,
yes.
And it was a major book that
mm-hmm.
was a Pulitzer winner, and I'm
right.
sure it's being read all over the world. So, in the same way, your work is kind of struggling with similar themes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's a valid worry.
You could be right.
Maybe you could be making millions.
You get a MacArthur grant.
That's a good one to get. Yeah.
Or I could get the grant that Daniel Jose Older just got to go to Cuba. I am so jealous of that, because I would love to, you know, it's, and this is a frustration that I've had more than one character, I think, express, that this island has shaped who I am in such an enormous, enormous way and cast such a long shadow on my life, and I've not been there.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, it is a vacancy that I feel in my life. And one thing I particularly would love, which there's no reason to believe that it could possibly happen, is I would love to visit Cuba with my father and have him share with me the elements of his life, so that it's not just... I do have this fear that if I were to travel to Cuba at some future date, I'd be traveling there as a tourist, you know, one who speaks Spanish, but as somebody who doesn't have any touchstone there, any experiences there. And that's a regret that I have. That's, you know, older.
So I don't know if we've heard much about your father, but
mm-hmm.
He left Cuba for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to just assume why, but maybe...
My father's father was an anti-Batista politician.
Okay.
With I won't get into specific sort of war people, but, you know, there were other people opposing Batista besides Castro. He wasn't the only one.
Oh.
So when Castro came to power, he was in the know enough to say, this guy's not good news. And so he got... not all at the same time, but he pretty much got his wife and his two kids out of Cuba while it was still possible to leave, while there was still a lot of fluidity there. And, of course, he was a fairly privileged person himself, so he could do that. My mother came over in Operación Pedro Pan, which, if you've never heard of it, is a fascinating story. You really might want to, if you're interested in this sort of thing, might want to look into. It's an airlift of Cuban children who were brought over to the United States and processed in Miami and sent to live with American foster parents.
Oh.
So, yeah, my mother came to the United States, went to live with a family in New Jersey, and eventually her father did make it over. I'm hazy on the details. There's an estrangement there, so I don't know a lot. But that's a fascinating period of history there.
Yeah. I've been doing a class, right now I'm teaching a class at a college level, which is on literatures of the Americas,
mm-hmm.
as a way to kind of challenge this idea of what is American literature. And while we didn't cover Cuba very long, it was really interesting to cover writers who'd had very different political perspectives, some of
mm-hmm.
them as pro and some of them anti-Castro, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really fascinating, too, to read about sort of the migration of Cuban immigrants. In particular, I believe I've forgotten the date, but I swear it was the 80s, they had this mass migration of, I can't remember how many peoples.
Was it the Mariel boatlift that you're...
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're just... I can't remember the number of people, but it was a hell of a lot of people just, like, got into rafts.
I mistakenly referred to Pedro Pan as a boatlift. Mariel was... Pedro Pan, I guess, was an airlift.
Actually did say it was an airlift.
Oh,
you did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the other one was a boat, and there were lots of boats. And I'm just really fascinated about the historically, just reading about it, because there'd already been an established Cuban-American
yes.
community in the U.S., and so what you'd ended up having was all these stories about these Cuban and Cuban-Americans just, like, getting boats and, like, driving out to go pick people up out of the waters.
Yeah.
I was alive, presumably, when this happened. I can't remember what
year.
Well,
I don't know if you remember all the news about Elian Gonzalez, because
mm-hmm.
he was the really famous little boy.
Oh, no, I would have been... This was in the 80s, was it?
Right. Elian was much later. But, yeah, it was early 80s.
I was probably
80s.
Too young.
I want to say 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, I wasn't even born yet. So I had to read about this.
We've all got these phones. We can look it up.
I don't know. There wasn't a question there. It was
yeah.
You were talking about this sort of immigrant experience, and I was really that's something that is more of a recent interest,
mm-hmm.
Looking at the very long and very complicated history there, and this idea of a community being constructed, and then obviously this concern you raise about going back and feeling like a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's on the one hand a very legitimate concern, because of course. You've not been there
right.
for so long. And it's, I think, a question that other, to use the phrase, minority communities
mm-hmm.
probably struggle with as well. I mean, even within the African community, these questions over stuff like Pan-Africanism, like,
mm-hmm.
at what point do you still have a connection to that place where your ancestors came from? It's a question I feel like a lot of groups certainly have, and perhaps even anyone who's from immigrant families maybe has to different levels, but...
But I think especially with people, for instance, if you are fleeing a country because you can't stay there, or if you're brought over on the slave trade because you've been kidnapped and then sold, then it's a different disconnect. And I've heard
Absolutely.
People
yeah.
from those cultures talk about the pain of researching their heritage, because if you don't, you know, if you know that your family came out of the American slave trade south,
sure.
then... What African country did you come from? We don't know necessarily. And so trying to really unearth your heritage is a lot more fraught than it might be for someone who's like your garden variety English Scottish mix.
I have very little, you know, in the way of family that I can ask, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, my only family in this country, other than my wife and my kids, of course, is my father. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different, you're right, it's a very different kind of disconnect. It's the, in many respects, the history is completely lost.
And
in
this
a
idea
different
that
way,
also with Cuba, especially, like you can't go back there, but
mm-hmm.
it's right there.
Well, technically, I could. You all can't.
Yeah, but
unless we're Beyonce.
Yes.
And what's it, Jay-Z?
Jay-Z. Yeah.
Somehow they got there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how, but
yeah.
Well, I feel like a total ignoramus now, because I don't know why specifically can you go. I mean, like not. Like,
mm-hmm.
There's a stupid side of that, but like there, obviously there's been some lift of embargoes.
Well, no, now I haven't really researched this because it's
okay.
never been something I've planned on doing in the near future. But I, if you've got roots in the island, you're still able to travel back there. I've all my life known people. It's not a recent thing. Even back in the 70s and 80s, somebody who would go back to visit their, you know, brother, mother, whoever they left behind.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And once you had your U.S. citizenship and could feel relatively secure in not being made to stay.
Yeah. Whoa, that's so fascinating. I always said,
It's actually a very controversial thing within the Cuban American community. Because if you go there with your dollars and spend that money around, then you are helping to prop up that economy. And I don't know how much water the idea that our actions in the United States can cause an economic collapse that will cause regime change to happen. And I don't know that idea holds water because we've been trying it for 60 years and it hasn't, you know, but...
Yeah,
but still, yeah.
I've read some arguments that suggest that actually by the U.S. so harshly clamping down that it actually gives Castro more power.
I do believe that. Because I think about what opened up the Soviet Union, you know, during the 80s, and it seemed that the more exposure there was to, you know, commercialism and to everything else that was going on for good and for ill, but whatever, the more people wanted more options than what they had. So I do think that for all the best of intentions, maybe, that's a plan that has not succeeded.
No. Just look at North Korea as just
right.
a sort of simplistic example, but I mean, they just had an election.
Yes, where
somehow you got 100%.
Everybody, yes.
Yeah, and it's like, well, I mean, assuming that everybody who voted did vote for him and they didn't just fudge the number, that tells you the level of control he already has. And clearly there's something is not working about whatever's going on here. Obviously, I'm not a global politics expert. I'm not in the Obama administration, so I have no idea what I'm talking about. But, you know, in case he's listening, he should hire me.
And for what it's worth, the opinions I'm expressing are very not representative of the Cuban-American community.
Right, you're speaking for yourself. Yeah. Well, okay, so sort of bounce back, what can we expect from you in presumably the near future? I mean, you're working on some sort of things in with words on them.
You know, I've given up writing. I'm just done.
Yeah, we've ruined his writing career. That's it.
Not too long ago, I finished up a novel hitting on a lot of those same themes called Goodbye, My Exile, that I've waited way too long to send to my agent, but I'm going to send it. I've committed to myself that by the end of my spring break, which is next week, I'm going to go ahead and be done revising and send it to her. And I have high hopes. I've spoken to some editors who said that they're very much looking for contemporary young adult, and they're very much looking for diversity, and this has that in spades.
Awesome.
So hopefully good things will happen there. And then assuming somebody doesn't start throwing money at me to write more books, I've really been looking forward to getting back into short fiction, because one of the frustrating things that I have experienced with this is, you know, I had a couple of sales and then I was working on this novel, and so nobody has seen anything else from me, and the number of stories I've got circulating has dwindled, and it just kind of... It's interesting to compare the novel writing process where you can, I'm sorry, the short story writing process where you can crank out a story in a fairly short amount of time and polish it up and you've got something out there making the rounds versus the novel that you spend a bunch of time, and obviously different people have different length writing processes, but you can spend forever on something before anything's actually circulating. So I really am looking forward to getting back into short stories in a couple weeks.
Good, that'll be great, so we can get some more work from you. You need to hurry up.
Will do.
Yeah, get some novels out. You just like you can't get a Pulitzer if you're not ready.
Or MacArthur.
I'm just saying. Or MacArthur, or the Hugo, the Nebula, James Tipper. You can't get James Tipper. Can you get that one?
I can. Not for anything I've written yet, but I can.
But the Tiptree Award is just for work that explores or expands our notions of gender.
Awesome. You can get that one, too.
Lambda.
Yeah, a Lambda.
No. Lambda? I was thinking the wrong one. No, I'm the...
Galactic?
Brandon.
Oh, yeah,
there you go.
I just haven't published
that
story yet.
You just have to write stories.
Well, we've figured out your career.
You're going to write one that fits for all... No, that's maybe not a great career bet, but write the stories that make you happy. Or, well, no, I don't know. Just
or else we'll
make
you... throw you
or plumb my misery, whichever.
Whichever works, yeah. So, okay, so where can folks find you on the interwebs to, you know...
Well,
stare at your web pages. And
my web page is labyrinthrat.com. Unfortunately, I know. Actually, you can just go to josearriarte.com or joearriarte.com. They all point there too. Unfortunately, I am not able to edit or post new pages at the moment because of some stupid WordPress thing that nobody wants to hear about. But so until I am, you can also find me on Twitter at labyrinthrat. And I guess that's...
that's it. Awesome.
And you can read Yuka and Domino's and Strange Horizons.
Yes.
So. Yep. We'll make sure there's a link in the show notes so folks can go read that. And I will... you're in the Halloween issue from last year?
Yes.
Okay, and Stupefying Stories. I'll make sure there's a link to that so people can...
So you said that one was called Cabron. Is it like a Chupacabra story?
It is. It is.
Awesome. Love the Chupacabra. It's a fun character. Lots of interesting takes on it, including X-Files has its own take.
This one has an interesting take on it.
Oh, is it? Oh, awesome.
I like this one.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, perfect. So everyone should go check out Jose's work, or Joe's work, whichever. You know, we'll switch your identities every week. It would be great. Everyone go check it out. Go check the show notes. And on that note, awkward ending.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to say thank you to everybody. I'm such a jerk.
Most awkward ending ever.
Yeah.
And also hitting your...
Yes,
I am.
Microphone.
It's not actually recording. So there.
And I'm going to call that scene.
Yeah.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.